San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you live from KFMB with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And if you have an app for AM 760, you can hear us there. You can hear us on 760kfmb.com and also all the archives at iymoney.com. But now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's a CPA extraordinaire. He's an accomplished marathon runner. He's a philanthropist. He's a best-selling author, and he's a family office expert advising several high-net-worth families. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Joe. Did you survive New Year's Eve?
Oh, I did. I just tried to keep it on the down low like most sane people, but I know a lot of people had fun. Even the Justice Sotomayor had fun in New York City. I don't know if you saw any of that, but
No, I was out having fun.
She dropped the ball, so to speak, but hopefully when she gets back in the court, they'll pick it up.
Yep.
Anyway, I don't want to waste any time because we have an illustrious, notable guest to kick off the new year. We had Irwin Jacobs last year and George Takei starting us off in January. And as our first guest of 2014, I would like to welcome to our show. He was a congressman from Michigan. He was an advisor and budget director to President Ronald Reagan. He was a best-selling author after he left the Reagan administration. And everyone in the country knows who he is. His name is David Stockman. David, good evening. How are you?
Very good, and happy to be with you.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
David, quick question. Did you watch the Rose Bowl? I know you went to Michigan State.
I should have, but I didn't.
No. Okay. Stanford did not quite pull that out at the end, so congrats to Michigan State.
Right.
Yeah. But, David, you were somewhat of a wunderkind. How old were you when you were elected to Congress from Michigan?
Well, I was actually 29 years old, and at the time I thought I knew a lot more than I did. But I can also say there were two other 29-year-olds elected with me that same year, 1976. One by the name of Al Gore, and the other by the name of Dan Quayle.
Oh, so, my gosh.
That was a good class. At least two of them amounted to something over time.
Talk about a crop. Boy, right. That's amazing. Boy, 29, not too many people are 29 get elected to Congress.
Every now and then. And I sort of lucked out. I was from a very Republican, hardcore conservative district in southwestern Michigan. But unfortunately, the incumbent, who had been there for, I think, 15 or 20 years, decided that he needed to defend Nixon to the bitter end in the Watergate process. He was a ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. He did not come across well with the electorate, and suddenly I threw my hat in the ring, and he quit, and it was all over. So.
The voters said enough is enough,
yeah,
I suppose.
Right.
Who was that that congressman?
His name was Ed Hutchinson. He was actually a pretty good conservative, but he was a Nixon loyalist, and it was a huge mistake because, as I say in my book, and we can get into this later, Nixon was one of the greatest catastrophes ever to hit American policy with what he did on the budget, on regulation, on wage and price controls, closing the gold window, opening up the central bank. To the next 35, 40 years of the kind of relentless money printing and manipulation we've had since then.
So, yeah. But I'm amazed that being 29 years old and you served, I guess, basically just one term.
Two terms.
I'm sorry. How did you endear yourself to the Reagan administration and move so rapidly and highly up the ladder on his side? Because you were with John Anderson, right?
I think that's the way it happened. It was kind of a fluke events. I had worked on Capitol Hill for 5 years before I was elected. I had worked for John Anderson, who was kind of an economic conservative, but a liberal or moderate on social issues, which, frankly, I think was probably the right position. But
I then
got into 1980, and as you remember, John Anderson ran as an independent.
He did.
And they were organizing the presidential debates, and Carter refused to be in a three-way debate. So it ended up they had two debates, one Reagan-Anderson, the first one, in Baltimore, then the second one would be later with Reagan and Carter. Well, as they were getting ready for the Anderson debate, the campaign managers, particularly Jim Baker, recognized that Anderson was one of the most fluent, brilliant, effective orators to, be in the House of Representatives for decades, if not longer, and they worried that Reagan would not do well, and it was only the warm-up, before the real contest with Carter. So they took Reagan off the campaign trail for a week, put him in a mock studio, and had day-long mock debate rehearsals day after day, and they drafted me to be John Anderson, thinking since I'd worked for him 5 years, I knew where he was coming from. And apparently it was successful because Ronald Reagan did quite well in the debate, far above expectation in the Baltimore debate with John Anderson. And so he then concluded I was his good luck charm for some reason. And then the big debate in Cleveland came right before the election with Jimmy Carter. And I was out in Michigan just running for re-election, didn't have much of an opponent. Suddenly I get a call from Jim Baker again saying I needed to get back to Washington pronto because I was going to be Jimmy Carter for a week in the same mock studio, same mock rehearsal. And as a result of that, Reagan practiced all of his lines on me, including that famous one that probably turned the debate, "There you go again, Mr. President," when he came after Carter. And so that was how I got connected. Shortly after the election, he called me and thanked me for all the help in the two debate rehearsals and said, "You know, we think we'd like to have a young guy like you in the administration. Is there any job you would be interested in?" I said, "Yeah, OMB." And it was done right there or in the next couple of days. So that isn't the normal route to these positions. I wasn't a trained economist. In fact, I went to Harvard Divinity School. But, you know, it was how it came about. And it was a pretty exciting time, at least for a few years, until the whole Reagan package began to burst at the seams because there was too much defense, too big a tax cut, and almost no domestic spending reforms or savings. And it ended up, in the ditch when it was started out to be an effort to fundamentally, revise and redirect, national economic policy.
But can I ask you a question about Reaganomics?
Sure.
I'm a CPA by training. It's always been my belief that a tax cut can really only increase revenue if you start in a zero inflation economy. And, of course, 30 years ago, we were hardly anywhere close to a zero inflation economy as a starting point.
Right.
And so, obviously, the I guess if you pump the inflation out, the we don't have that bracket creep that would cause taxes to increase.
You hit it right on the head, and that was one of the complications that happened in the early 80s, and some of the true believers, supply-side true believers, just wouldn't recognize it. There was a tremendous case for income tax rate reductions in 1981 because we'd been through a decade of really virulent inflation. It was, as people might remember, in double digits near the end of the decade. But then
we had interest rates as high as
18%. Pushed up into much higher brackets. There was a revenue windfall coming in when we looked at a five-year projection in early 1981 when the Reagan administration took office. Revenue over the next 5 years would have crept up from about 18.5% to 21% of GDP. So there was a huge case for a reduction. But what happened was Volcker was even more successful than anybody could have anticipated at crushing the double-digit inflation. It dropped by 1982 to 3.5% and continued to go down over the next couple of years. Therefore, the amount of bracket creep built into the baseline was much lower. Therefore, the starting revenues were much lower, and unfortunately, when we got into the political contest on the Hill to cut taxes, a bidding war ensued, and we not only got the rate cuts, but then on top of that, massive further reductions through, you know, every kind of loophole that the Beltway lobbies and K Street lobbies demanded in return for supporting the bill. So when you put those two together, a tax cut that on a statutory basis was almost double what was intended, and second, a revenue or an inflation disinflation collapse beyond the well beyond the projections, we ended up with a huge shortfall of revenue. The budget gap opened up to levels never previously seen, 5% of GDP, and you were in a totally different ball game than what was intended by the Reagan, plan, and what was proposed by President Reagan in the 1980 election.
David, let's take a break right now. Hold that thought. Ladies and gentlemen, David Stockman, author of The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. We'll be right back with more after this break. All right. We're back with David Stockman, former budget director to President Ronald Reagan, best-selling author, whose latest book, The Great Deformation. And where do we leave off, David?
Where we left off was during the Reagan era. I think one of the points that I make in the book, which is really important, is that the big budget deficits that emerged during that period would have been self-correcting, in my judgment, politically, had we had sound money as a backdrop. And what I mean by that is prior to 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, basically defaulted on our international obligation to convert dollars into gold at $35 an ounce, once that breach was made and the central bank, the Federal Reserve, was therefore kind of unleashed to run an entirely discretionary policy and to expand its balance sheet at potentially an unlimited rate, which you could not do in a fixed exchange rate system under Bretton Woods in a gold-anchored system. Obviously, if you expanded the Fed at that rate, which they did in the 70s afterwards, you can see what the consequences were. But in any rate, once Nixon crossed that Rubicon, and I think it was one of the most fatal mistakes in modern economic policy of the last 50 years, it created a condition where the Fed could basically be the buyer of last resort for these, rapidly growing levels of deficit and the rapidly accumulating level of national debt.
And as a result
of that, you didn't have the same immediate adverse impact on the economy. Interest rates were not pushed up artificially. Inflation remained reasonably subdued after Volcker defeated it the first time, and we can go into some of the reasons. But as a result of that, there was no crowding out from government borrowing. There was no negative impact on capital spending and on the business sector. And so over time, people became, sort of adjusted to the fact that deficits weren't that painful in the short run. And so therefore, they either, adopted the view that we'll get to the problem someday, but not right now, or went so far as Cheney did, which I think was a horrible mistake when we got to the Bush administration, and said Reagan proved deficits don't matter. Mm-hmm. I think Nixon proved that if you have a totally discretionary central bank that is free to monetize the debt and absorb the fiscal excess and recklessness of Capitol Hill in the White House, that's what was proved, then you will end up with a kind of bubble economy, artificial leverage, driven growth that we've had in the years since then.
What did you think of former Secretary of Treasury Paul O'Neill going in to meet with President Bush early on in the first month, and I guess was very disappointed in the conversation? He brought in his yellow pad and wanted some direction with regard to policy, and I guess there was none forthcoming, and he did the honorable thing that you did. He resigned. But I know he's one of the heroes in your book, but what did you think of that? So that kind of set the course of disaster that was to come, right?
Yeah, it was. And fortunately, that was the second moment in time. I think there's two or three big inflection points in the last 50 years that got us to this massively debt-inflated, debt-ridden, both public and private sector that we have today. But another one beyond Nixon's Camp David, errors in August 1971, was the Bush administration decision to implement the Cheney theorem, as I call it. Deficits don't matter. And so we ended up with the two big tax cuts, which O'Neill said we couldn't afford, and, two wars that we didn't need, a soaring defense budget that doubled in a couple of short years, and the final breakdown of fiscal rectitude, as I call it, and it happened on a Republican watch, which I think is even more devastating, because you had a Republican House and Senate and White House for six of those years, mm-hmm. and fiscal policy went into the ditch big time, and I don't know how we're ever going to get out as a result of that. And we have now a political system which is dysfunctional because Republicans only talk about deficits, are unwilling to go after spending in the magnitude that is needed. They constantly push for more tax cuts that we can't afford. And, of course, the Democrats are happy to go both ways. After all, Obama extended all the Bush tax cuts except for the top 2% and took credit for that, after the Democrats had denounced the Bush tax cut for years. And, of course, he's unwilling to cut any spending and is always trying to actually add to spending through these infrastructure projects and so forth. So you have two free lunch parties. You have what I call a doomsday machine in the form of the federal budget. It's just rolling forward, generating red ink, building the national debt to almost obscene levels, mm-hmm. and very little prospect that the political system has any capacity to do anything about it. Well, this all originated, when the Fed was unleashed, when the traditional in 1971 under Nixon, and when the traditional idea of keeping the budget balanced during peacetime was essentially lost during the Reagan era, and then you put Bush and Greenspan together in the early 2000s, and you sort of baked the cake of what I think is the huge disaster that's forming today.
You had a big issue with Reagan with the respect to the massive increase in military spending, right? Wasn't that one of your issues?
Oh, that was one of the real internal battles of the administration, and obviously. I have some chapters about this in the book because mm-hmm. I think one of the things that happened was there was a massively exaggerated notion of the Soviet arms buildup and nuclear threat in 1980 coming from the neocons. It turns out it was totally exaggerated. A lot of people knew it at the time. And beyond that, the Soviet Union was kind of catapulted into some kind of evil empire mm-hmm. that was going to conquer the world, when in fact, if Republicans had taken their free market gospel seriously, if they understood seriously the inherent flaws of socialism and state in a state-driven economy, and had looked with a clear view, clear-eyed take on the Soviet Union, even then it was clear that it was coming unraveled, that the system was failing, that the economy of the Soviet Union was in dire shape, and the whole so-called evil empire was heading for a collapse. It didn't happen out of the blue. It didn't happen suddenly in a day in 1989 or 90 or 91, finally, when Yeltsin got on the tank. Mm-hmm. It'd been underway for 30 or 40 years. Right. By 1980, it was, in the sundown era. And so we didn't need this massive defense buildup. We ended up with a huge conventional war machine that was irrelevant to the so-called nuclear threat that wasn't real from the Soviet Union, but it became available to subsequent presidents to use to carry on wars of invasion and occupation that weren't really in the national security interest of the United States.
But also, didn't President Reagan fall in love with the so-called Laffer curve to the extent that he couldn't really consider any other options or opinions?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. There is something to the Laffer curve. If taxes are high enough and you cut them, you will probably get an improvement in entrepreneurial activity and risk-taking and economic growth and therefore income and revenue. But it all depends where you are on the curve. The tax rates were too high in 1980, but they weren't so high that the tax cuts were going to be 100% self-financing, as some people thought. We very carefully in our budget plans at the time showed that we thought there would be a little bit of extra economic growth, but that you had to earn the tax cuts partly by spending cuts. It wasn't all going to be, you know, supply-side magic. But unfortunately, in President Reagan's mind, when push came to shove and hard choices needed to be made, and when he was presented with the massive deficit projections that we had for the future, he tended to think that we were underestimating revenue and that the Laffer curve would be more effective or powerful. It just wasn't true. It didn't happen. On his watch, the national debt was increased by $1.3 trillion, which was just unimaginable at the time, since when he took office, the national debt was only $1 trillion. So he more than doubled the national debt, which is a an extreme irony, because Ronald Reagan spent most of his political life when he was before he was governor and on the speaking circuit, then governor, and then in the 70s excoriating the deficit, preaching the gospel of fiscal rectitude and balanced budgets, and he got into office and ended up with a record that was, 100% opposite. Now, it wasn't the $1.3 trillion of debt that he added that was the bad thing in and of itself. It was more the impact it had on the Republican Party and on Republican politicians, who basically lost their belief, lost their philosophical commitment during that period to fiscal responsibility and rectitude, and began to preach the gospel of tax cuts without regard to the fiscal consequence. And I think that was the turning point that has led us to a, as I said before, a doomsday machine in our fiscal process, and a national debt that will soon be at $20 trillion and rising, well more than 100% of GDP,
wow,
which isn't sustainable, obviously. People know that, yeah. And yet Washington sits on its hands, stalemated and helpless, because the commitment to fiscal rectitude was lost in the 1980s.
Well, we've got to get a turning point right here, David. We'll come right back with David Stockman, some solutions and ideas. He's the author of The Great Deformation. We'll be right back after this. Hang on. All right, we're back actually at KFMB, and now over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
Oh, also, Mr. Stockman, my daughter Demi, who's a high school senior, wanted you to know that she got all of her OMB questions on her economics test correct before she took off for holidays. So anyway, thank you to our sponsors, Mr. Michael Karantra and Drew Freitas with UBS. Couldn't do it without you folks. Also, right across the street from UBS in downtown La Jolla, Regents Bank, the best business bank here in San Diego, with Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group, helping businesses improve their value and reduce their risk. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Our favorite CFO service on the planet, that's Mr. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics. Paul Polito, CPA, and Don Epic, CPA, with Polito Epic CPAs, gearing up for yet another tax season, and maybe we can discuss that a little bit later in the show, because I think the whole system's broken. Brenda Geiger with Geiger Law Offices, thank you, Brenda, for being on board to help people with estate planning and asset protection, Geiger Law Offices. And last but not least, with a big event coming up very soon on February 4th and 5th at the Omni in downtown San Diego, Servant Leadership Institute, servantleadershipinstitute.com. If you want to find out how to be a great leader, join leadership experts Ken Blanchard, Stephen Covey, and Dick Enberg, one of our best friends here on the show. at their event in downtown San Diego on Feb 4th and 5. And Joe, how can our wonderful listeners find out more about our great sponsors?
Well, all they have to do is click on iymoney.com. That's iymoney.com. Click on the sponsors tab. All their personal information is there, their contact information, their biographical information is there, and you can get a hold of them. And Richard's worked with them for many, many years with a lot of positive, successful outcomes. Right, Richard?
We have indeed. In fact, I've been real busy with a bunch of them just before year end, trying to beat these darn income taxes that are broken.
Yeah. And speaking of iymoney.com, you'll be able to hear this podcast with David Stockman, who's on the line and author of The Great Deformation. And we'd like to get into some of his solutions and ideas, because we're in a heap of trouble and debt right now, right, David?
Yes, absolutely. And not just the federal debt, which people are aware of and is so visible, the $17 trillion and rising, but the total debt, public and private, in our economy has reached unimaginable levels. It is now $58 trillion if you take business, household, financial, and public sector debt. That is roughly 3.5 times GDP. That ratio, you could consider the leverage ratio for the American economy as a whole. It is off the charts compared to anything that proved itself to be sustainable and sound historically. I note in my book that pre-1980, the ratio of total public and private debt to national income was about 1.5 times. It had been at that level, plus or minus a little, for more than a century, notwithstanding, you know, boom and bust and war and peace and everything else that happened between 1870 and 1980. That was kind of the golden norm. It was consistent with a robust private, capitalist economy, rising living standards, continuous growth over time. But once we passed 1980 and we had a Fed that was on leash to print money, and we had a fiscal system that was on leash to accumulate deficits, and all the other distortions that went with it, our total debt in the system soared and went from a healthy 1.5 ratio to a utterly unsustainable and destructive 3.5, as I mentioned a moment ago. Now, people could say, well, okay, the leverage ratio for a $16 trillion economy, that's interesting, but why is it so important? What does it mean? The answer is, had we stayed on the straight and narrow, on the healthy leverage ratio, public and private, that we had prior to 1980, debt in the U.S. economy today would be less than $30 trillion, not $58
trillion.
Yeah. So we're carrying around, as a economy and society, about $30 trillion of household and business and government debt that wouldn't be there had we kept policy on a sound and sustainable track after 1980.
Yeah.
I think that's important because it tells you that where we are today in 2014 cannot be assessed simply by comparing it to last year or 2 years ago or 4 years ago. We have a huge recency bias where we seem to forget in the daily babble that happens about the economy and the economic reports that come out monthly. We have a recency bias where we have lost all sight of where we were several decades ago or over the last century and how far we've strayed from sustainable fundamentals. And that's why I don't believe this recovery is real. That's why I believe we're in another
huge bubble
in the financial system and in the so-called risk asset markets, the third one of this century. And I think it's not going to have a happy outcome.
And then can you address derivatives a little bit? And how did that genie get out of the bottle, or maybe so? Maybe a satanic.
I think all of this, and I lay it out, it's a long story, but I lay it out in several chapters in my book, is a result of the instability and the financialization that results when we go to a central bank-driven system rather than one that is anchored in a more permanent value, such as the Bretton Woods version of the gold standard that we had up through 1971. Mm-hmm. So when you have highly unstable exchange rates rather than fixed exchange rates. When you have interest rates that move, you know, massively as they did in the 70s and 80s, unlike the stable environment you had pre, you know, 1960, then the market will invent ways for participants to cope with the instability, the financial inflation, the leverage expansion and risks that result from a system that's enabled by what I call, you know, fiat money and massive central bank expansion. So that's where all this came from, and it's just creating even more, you know, fundamental instability and risk in the system that's somewhat hidden on a day-to-day basis until it suddenly explodes, as happened in September 2008, and then we get another meltdown and crisis. I think it's only a matter of time. The financial system today is a ticking time bomb, and it's only a matter of time before there is some, you know, black swan that appears or some unexpected trauma or crisis that triggers another, you know, violent and massive sell-off of stocks and bonds and, you know, other risk assets.
Yeah. We got to go to a break right now, though, Dave. We'll come back for that. We'll make you President Stockman in the last segment. We'll come up with some solutions. How about
okay,
that? So
good.
We'll come right back right after this. Hang on. All right, we're back in our final segment with David Stockman, author of The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. And Richard, how should we do this?
I want to talk about income taxes since we're moving into what's commonly known as tax season for CPAs. You know, I represent some very high net worth families, David, and of course we deal a lot with estate tax mitigation, reduction, elimination, as well as income tax planning. And I have to make the comment, the whole system is so, in my opinion, irreparably broken and incentivized to special interests that I think we need to start over. I know in your book you mentioned this concept of a consumption tax. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think the income tax is irreparably broken. The tax code has now become just a plaything, I guess you could say, of the K Street lobbies and the massive you know, raids on the Treasury that occur when special interest groups attempt to carve out loopholes or incentives in order to benefit their constituencies or their sector or part of the economy. As a result of that, it's clear to me that all this talk about tax reform is just that, hot air. We did get the tax code somewhat cleaned up in 1986 when we had the Reagan reform that broadened the tax base and closed a lot of loopholes that existed at the time and lowered the top rate to 28%. But now here we are, you know, 25 years later, and all of that is gone. The tax code has now been riddled with new kinds of loopholes and incentives beyond anything that was imaginable then. Rates are much higher, and the system is just in danger of collapsing on itself. So I think we've had a pretty good demonstration over the last couple of decades that in our kind of money-driven, PAC-driven, lobby-driven legislative system, an income tax is inherently vulnerable to this kind of corruption that I've described. And therefore, we ought to start over with a consumption tax that's applied on everything at the point of sale. And it would be far more efficient administratively, and it would generate the revenue that we need in this country to pay our bills. Now, people will say it's regressive. You know, that is an argument you can make, but it's not a good argument for the keeping the income tax and eschewing a consumption tax. Because even the current income tax is, you know, vulnerable to all kinds of preferences that undermine its so-called progressivity. So I think our economy desperately needs to have less consumption, more savings, more investment, more entrepreneurial activity. The way to get there is to remove all of this massive barrier that's created by the income tax tax consumption, encourage production, and maybe we can dig our way out of this huge hole that we're in today.
Yeah. Yeah, and further, income taxes are regressive when if you consider that the Social Security tax is basically part of the income tax.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point to make and one that I make in the book. The irony is that the biggest defenders of the myth of Social Security and social insurance and therefore the need for these high payroll taxes, which are really job killers, you know, between the employer and the employee, Medicare, Social Security, it's 15% plus today. And that is a devastating impact on the entry-level jobs or the lower-paying jobs, which seem to be the only kind that our economy can generate.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were rational, we would say the number one job killer in America today is these high payroll taxes, that the payroll tax needs to be dramatically reduced or eliminated in favor of the consumption tax that I've been talking about, and that we need to tell the truth. There is no trust fund. There is no social insurance system. It's a pay-as-you-go generational transfer that we can't afford and that needs to be basically reformed and means-tested on the benefit side and funded out of more general revenues, consumption tax revenues on the resource side.
Now, if you were President Stockman, I think you've got some great ideas in the back of your book as far as term limits. We have them, you know, with the state and local level. We don't have them at the federal level. And you're suggesting a six-year term for presidents, Congress members, and senators. Is that correct?
Yes. I think as long as we have the two-year election cycle, as long as 435 members of the House spend every waking hour thinking about the next election and, you know, plying the corridors of Washington looking for PAC contributions and lobby support, we will never break out of the impasse that that we're in today.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need a radical change in our political system. It would take a constitutional amendment, and that would be very hard to achieve. But you at least have to lay out the problem and a solution, even if it's radical. So what I've recommended is six-year terms for the House, Senate, and President. You cannot run for re-election. That there would be no PAC or union money allowed in elections, and that people would basically be elected once as citizen legislators, spend their 6 years without having to go to one fundraising event, trying to further the public good as they see it, and then go back to, you know, San Diego or Dallas, Texas, or wherever they're from, and resume their life as an ordinary citizen. Now, that is a huge change from, you know, the Beltway system that we have today, which is just a professional governing class that, you know, represents their own self-perpetuation rather than what, you know, the good of the vast expanse of Main Street America.
And limit campaigns to 8 weeks. And how about forcing media to give a certain number of minutes, donate them to candidates rather than, because that, of course,
yeah, well,
that's not
going
to go over big at the station.
Was, when I started working on Capitol Hill in 1970, that long ago, 44 years ago, that was one of the reforms that was being pressed even then. And here we are, you know, all these decades later, and even that small reform hasn't been made. But I think if we change the system to a I call it abolishing incumbency, and we got back to the notion of a citizen government, and if we recognize the political parties today accomplish nothing, they represent nothing except their own self-perpetuation. Oh, they both have their platforms, but they're to, you know, they ignore them when it comes to the hard choices of government. That, you know, we don't need big political parties in this system in the day and age that we live today. And the way to do that is abolish incumbency, public finance of short 6 or 8 week campaigns. Every 2 years, one third of the Congress would be up for election, so there would be constant, public input into the direction of government. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the only way that we can break the stranglehold of money politics and incumbency self-perpetuation that we have today. I noted that your chance of, as an incumbent in the House, of losing your seat is even lower than what it was in the Soviet Union in terms of losing a seat on the Politburo.
Are there any groups or organizations that are lobbying for these ideas, David?
I don't think so. I mean, there are some good government groups that want to try to reduce the massive flow of dollars, billions of dollars, into the campaign process. But, the idea that I've proposed here is pretty radical, but when you think it through, if we don't do something that's drastic and radical, I don't see how we, stop the drift towards disaster that the course that we seem to be on.
David, we have to thank you at this point.
Mr. Stockman, thanks so much.
Yeah, we really appreciate having
you
on.
Happy New Year to you.
Maybe you need to start a group up, David. We'll sign up for it if you do.
I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Happy New Year. Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Thank you. Happy New Year, folks. Get the book, Great Deformation, Corruption of Capitalism America. Thank you, Richard, for being on the show.
Joe, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks to Justin Hart, our sound engineer, making us sound great. Thanks to Craig Blank, our account executive, and to Dave Sniff, our programming genius. You have a great week, everybody. Happy New Year. We'll see you next week. Good night.